And as Capitol Hill prepares for an August recess and the national political conventions, much activity is taking place in Washington. The CEOs of the biggest social media and tech firms testified remotely on their role in American society. The House worked on money matters, and another coronavirus federal relief bill is also being formed and debated. Whether any substantive bills pass and get signed into law before Congress leaves is still to be determined. Also today, President Trump traveled to Texas to discuss energy, and the body of Representative John Lewis has returned to Atlanta to be remembered in the congressional district he represented for nearly 33 years. Good evening, and thanks for joining us on Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Peter Slem. Now, we begin tonight on Capitol Hill, where both Democrats and Republicans attack social media and tech firms. The CEOs of Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Apple all appeared virtually before the House Judiciary Committee. And according to the Washington Post, quote, each of the tech executives sought to tell their own versions of a rags-to-riches story, stressing their importance to U.S. consumers and the American economy as a whole. And all four tech companies emphasized they face healthy competition in advertising, search, shopping, and social networking. Now, here are portions from today's hearings. We'll begin with Amazon's Jeff Bezos.
The retail market we participate in is extraordinarily large and competitive. Amazon accounts for less than 1% of the $25 trillion global retail market and less than 4% of U.S. retail. There's room in retail for multiple winners. We compete against large, established players like Target, Costco, Kroger, and, of course, Walmart, a company more than twice Amazon's size. 20 years ago, we made the decision to invite other sellers to sell in our store to share the same valuable real estate we spent billions to build, market, and maintain. We believe that combining the strengths of Amazon's store with the vast selection of products offered by third parties would be a better experience for customers, and that the growing pie of revenue and profits would be big enough for all. We were betting that it was not a zero-sum game. Fortunately, we were right. There are now 1.7 million small and medium-sized businesses selling on Amazon. The trust customers put in us every day has allowed Amazon to create more jobs in the United States over the past decade than any other company. Hundreds of thousands of jobs across 42 states. Amazon employees make a minimum of $15 an hour, more than double the federal minimum wage.
And that was Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. Next up, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, who emphasized the importance of competition in the U.S.
We're here to talk about online platforms, but I think the true nature of competition is much broader. When Google bought YouTube, they could compete against the dominant player in video, which is the cable industry. When Amazon bought Whole Foods, they could compete against Kroger's and Walmart. When Facebook bought WhatsApp, we could compete against telcos who used to charge 10 cents a text message, but not anymore. Now people can watch video, get groceries delivered, and send private messages for free. That's competition. New companies are created all the time, all over the world. And history shows that if we don't keep innovating, someone will replace every company here today. And that change can often happen faster than you expect. Of the 10 most valuable companies a decade ago, only three still make that list today. And if you look at where the top technology companies come from, a decade ago, the vast majority were American. Today, almost half are Chinese.
And that was Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Next, from today's House Judiciary Committee meeting, we'll hear from Google CEO Sundar Pichai. He stressed the importance of Google during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Google's work would not be possible without the long tradition of American innovation, and we are proud to contribute to its future. They employ more than 75,000 people in the U.S. across 26 states. The Progressive Policy Institute estimated that in 2018, we invested more than $20 billion in the U.S., citing us as the largest capital investor in America that year, and one of the top five for the last 3 years. One way we contribute is by building helpful products. Research found that free services like Search, Gmail, Maps, and Photos provide thousands of dollars a year in value to the average American. and many are small businesses using our digital tools to grow. Stone Dimensions, a family-owned stone company in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, uses Google My Business to draw more customers. Gills Appliances, a family-owned appliance store in Bristol, Rhode Island, credits Google Analytics with helping them reach customers online during the pandemic. Nearly one-third of small business owners say that without digital tools, they would have had to close all or part of their business during COVID.
And that was Alphabet, the parent company of Google CEO Sundar Pichai, earlier today on Capitol Hill. And the fourth CEO, Apple CEO Tim Cook, described his company's legacy and expressed his desire to have more transparency and openness in the tech industry.
I'm here today because scrutiny is reasonable and appropriate. We approach this process with respect and humility, but we make no concession on the facts. What began as 500 apps is now more than 1.7 million, only 60 of which are Apple software. If Apple is a gatekeeper, what we've done is open the gate wider. We want to get every app we can on the store, not keep them off. The App Store's economic contributions are significant. The ecosystem is responsible for 1.9 million jobs in all 50 states, and it facilitated $138 billion in commerce in the U.S. in 2019 alone. I share the committee's belief that competition promotes innovation, that it makes space for the next great idea, and that it gives consumers more choices. Since Apple was founded, these things have defined us. The first Mac brought opportunity and possibility into the home. The iPod helped musicians and artists to share their creations and be paid fairly for it. This legacy does much more than make us proud. It inspires us to work tirelessly to make sure tomorrow will be even better than today.
And that was Apple CEO Tim Cook earlier today on Capitol Hill. Now, after the opening statements, both Republicans and Democrats took turns questioning the CEOs. Wisconsin Republican Congressman James Sensenbrenner, a former chair of the Judiciary Committee, questioned Mark Zuckerberg about a video involving a doctor who has touted hydroxychloroquine as a cure and asked whether the company had censored President Trump in removing it. Mr. Zuckerberg pointed out that the president retweeted the video on Twitter, not on Facebook. And Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin also questioned the Facebook CEO over that company's role in fostering social division in the U.S. Here's the Maryland Democrat.
So, Mr. Zuckerberg, which parts of this narrative have you addressed or are you planning to address, or do you just see that essentially as the cost of being a forum in a marketplace for ideas? Is there nothing that can be done about the use of Facebook to engender social division in America?
Congressman, thank you. Since 2016, there have been a lot of steps that we've taken to protect the integrity of elections. We've hired, I think it's more than 30,000 people to work on safety and security. We've built up AI systems to be able to find harmful content, including being able to find more than 50 different networks of coordinated and authentic behavior, basically nation states trying to interfere in elections.
Let me just pause you there for a second, because I'm interested in that. The Stop Hate for Profit campaign is a coalition that includes the Color of Change, the Anti-Defamation League, and other civil rights groups, and they're targeting Facebook right now for a boycott because of the rapid spread of hate messages online, the presence of Boogaloo and other right-wing extremist groups trying to infiltrate and disrupt Black Lives Matter protests, and the fact that alt-right, racist, and anti-Semitic content flourishes on Facebook. So they're asking you to remove these pages and essentially to join the movement for civil rights by not allowing that kind of content. Their boycotters include a lot of big companies, including Patagonia, Levi's, McDonald's, VW, Heineken, and so on. But you seem not to be that moved by their campaign, and I just wonder what you think about what they're asking you to do.
Congressman, thanks. We're very focused on fighting against election interference, and we're also very focused on fighting against hate speech. And our commitments to those issues and fighting them go back years before this recent movement. Since 2016, the defenses that the company has built up to help secure elections, not just in the U.S., but around the world, I think are some of the most advanced that any company or government has in the world now. We routinely now collaborate with law enforcement and intelligence agencies and are able to sometimes identify threats coming from other countries before governments are even able to. In terms of fighting hate, we've built really sophisticated systems. Our goal is to identify it before anyone even sees it on the platform. And we've built AI systems and, as I mentioned, have tens of thousands of people working on safety and security with the goal of getting this stuff down so that way before people even see it. And right now, we're able to proactively identify 89% of the hate speech that we take down before I think it's even seen by other people. So, you know, I want to do better than 89%. I'd like to get that to 99%. But we have a massive investment here.
And that was Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg in an exchange with Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin. Now, Republican Jim Jordan of Ohio questioned Google CEO Sundar Pichai over the 2020 campaign and asked if Google would be helping presumptive Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. Here's that exchange.
Mr. Pichai, is Google going to tailor its features to help Joe Biden in the 2020 election?
Congressman, we approach our work, we support both campaigns today. We think political ads is an important part of free speech in democratic societies, and we engage with campaigns, according to law, and we approach our work in a nonpartisan way.
It was a yes or no question. Can you assure Americans today you won't tailor your features to help Joe Biden in the upcoming election?
We support work that campaigns do. I just want to make sure I
understand that. We all do all kinds of online social media, all kinds of that kind of, that outreach, that communication. This is a simple question. Can you today assure Americans you will not tailor your features in any way to help, specifically help one candidate over other? And this what I'm concerned about is you helping Joe Biden over President Trump.
We won't do any work, to politically tilt anything one way or the other. It's against our core values, Congressman.
But you did it in 2016. There's an email in 2016 that was widely circulated amongst the executives at your company that got public, where Ms. Ileana Murillo, head of your multicultural marketing, talks about the silent donation Google made to the Clinton campaign. And you applauded her work. She points that out in the email. I'm just curious, if you did it in 16, I want to make, in spite of the fact you did it in 16, President Trump won, I just want to make sure you're not going to do it again in 2020.
Congressman, I recall our conversation at that time, and I appreciate your concern. We didn't find any evidence of such activity. And I took the opportunity after our conversation to reinforce to the company. We realized even an appearance could be improper, so we have clearly communicated to our employees any personal political activity, while that's their right, needs to happen on their own time and resources and should avoid any use of company.
Well, of course, everyone's got their First Amendment rights to campaign for who they want. What they can't do is configure your features to help one candidate over the other.
And that was Sundar Pichai of Alphabet and Congressman Jim Jordan, the top Republican on the House Judiciary Committee. Now joining us is Roger Cheng, executive editor of CNET News. Mr. Cheng, was Jim Jordan correct that social media companies are out to get conservatives?
Yeah, the claim that these companies have a bias against conservatives in particular, it's one that's been long touted and one that the tech industry has dismissed or argued against. It's a very complicated question because a lot of the examples that Representative Jordan put out, really illustrates a pattern of bias. But if you look closely, there are different kind of complicated answers that require a bit more context. And so it's hard to really answer that question definitively, but, I don't think these tech companies are motivated by politics necessarily.
And now the hearing is still going on, but so far, both Democrats and Republicans have been attacking the CEOs of Apple and Facebook and Alphabet and Amazon, including Pramila Jayapal, who represents Amazon. She asked very pointed questions to Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, it was interesting that Jeff Bezos was basically sitting there without anything to say for nearly 2 hours in the session before Representative Jayapal asked that first question. It was a fairly pointed question, an informed one, about whether or not Amazon takes the data that it gains from working with other retailers to basically produce copycat products that can outmaneuver those other retailers. And so Jeff Bezos, after sort of sitting pretty there for a while, really didn't have a great answer and couldn't really assure the committee that that this practice of using the data, which they say they have rules against, wasn't being violated on a regular basis.
And now it's been a while coming, but tech firms and Democrats used to be relatively simpatico, didn't they?
For a long time, the tech industry was a darling of D.C. It was an example of American success story, right? This is so much of this power, so much of this wealth and business opportunity was created by the tech industry. And that still holds true. Obviously, they've revolutionized the way we communicate with each other, the way we connect with each other. But over the last year or two, we've seen a backlash. We've seen how too much power can, potentially be cause for concern when it comes to anti-competitive practices, when it comes to potential harm to consumers. And so you're starting to see not just lawmakers, but consumers really start to look at these companies a little bit more skeptically over the last few years.
So what was the original purpose of today's hearing?
So the original purpose of this hearing was to look at whether or not these companies were engaging in anti-competitive practices. And I think it's underscored by how different and how varied the conversations went by the fact that these companies are fundamentally different, right? They all have different areas where they dominate. And I think that's probably why the conversations from one lawmaker to another, they just are whiplashed between different topics. And it seemed all over the place. But the common theme, again, is like, are these companies too powerful and are they using that power to stamp out potential competitors?
So like you said, this hearing has been all over the place, but have we learned anything today?
Less so. Keep in mind, these hearings are basically political theater. These are lawmakers who are making points and oftentimes cutting off executives before they get into any substantial answers because the point of that question was to make that comment or to make that statement. And so I don't know if we're learning a huge amount. I think right now it seems like if you were just to look at who's probably in the coziest position as of at least the first 3 hours, I think Tim Cook was sitting relatively unscathed as most of the questions were directed to the other three executives.
Roger Chang, for those who don't know, what is CNET?
CNET is one of the world's largest tech consumer news and advice sites. So if you need advice on which computer, which phone to buy, or if you just want to know what's going on in the tech world, we break that all down for you.
Roger Chang is the executive editor of CNET News. Thanks for being on Washington Today. The hearing with the tech CEOs is available on our website at cspan.org. And you're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Peter Slim. Now, in other news, Oregon Governor Kate Brown and the Trump administration announced an agreement aimed at de-escalating tensions outside the federal courthouse, where federal agents have clashed with demonstrators during nightly unrest. The governor said that the agents would leave on Thursday, but acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf told The Washington Post that federal officials would pull back from Portland, quote, should circumstances on the ground significantly improve. Also, President Trump tweeted Wednesday that, quote, I am happy to inform all of the people living their suburban lifestyle dream that you will no longer be bothered or financially hurt by having low-income housing built in your neighborhood. Your housing prices will go up based on the market and crime will go down. I have rescinded the Obama-Biden AFFH rule. Enjoy. Now, the 2015 Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing rule requires local governments to ensure fair housing in order to receive federal housing funding. It was designed to empower the Fair Housing Act in combating segregation. When passed in 2015, civil rights groups praised it. HUD Secretary Ben Carson called the 2015 rule change overreach. Now to the Federal Reserve, where today they announced the interest rate will remain near zero and warned that the U.S. economic outlook is highly dependent on the pandemic. Here's Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell.
The pandemic continues to cause tremendous human and economic hardship here in the United States and around the world. The most important response to this public health crisis has come from our healthcare workers, and we remain grateful to them and to the many other essential workers for putting themselves at risk day after day in service to others and to our country. All of us have a role to play in our nation's response to the pandemic. At the Federal Reserve, we remain committed to using our tools to do what we can, and for as long as it takes, to provide some relief and stability, to ensure that the recovery will be as strong as possible, and to limit lasting damage to the economy. In recent months, economic activity picked up as the economy began to reopen. Many businesses opened their doors, factories restarted production, and more people left their homes to engage in various activities. As a result, household spending looks to have recovered about half of its earlier decline, although spending for services such as air travel and hotels has shown much less of a pickup. The recovery in household spending also likely owes to federal stimulus payments and expanded unemployment benefits, which provided substantial and timely support to household incomes. In contrast, indicators of business fixed investment have yet to show a recovery. Even with the improved economic news in May and June, overall activity remains well below its level before the pandemic, and the contraction in real GDP in the second quarter will likely be the largest on record. The labor market has followed a similar pattern. After precipitous drops in March and April, employment rose strongly in May and June as many people returned to work from temporary layoffs. As a result of the roughly 22 million jobs that had been lost, about one-third had been regained as of the June payroll report. The unemployment rate declined in May and June, but at 11.1%, remains far above its level before the outbreak and greater than the peak during the global financial crisis. In addition, the downturn has not fallen equally on all Americans, and those least able to bear the burden have been the most affected. In particular, the rise in joblessness has been especially severe for lower-wage workers, for women, and for African Americans and Hispanics. This reversal of economic fortune has upended many lives and created great uncertainty about the future.
And that was Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell earlier today. Texas Republican Representative Louis Gohmert announced today that he had tested positive for the coronavirus. He had up to now refused to wear a mask and was scheduled to fly to Texas with President Trump today, but he is now quarantining for at least 10 days. Here's Representative Gohmert on KETK-TV discussing his diagnosis.
I think this used to be what was called a free country, and people could do what they thought was appropriate. And if somebody feels strongly about everybody should wear a mask, then they shouldn't be around people that don't wear masks. But I do feel once somebody has been found to have the coronavirus, that they should wear a mask, preferably not even be in public. But if they are, absolutely wear a mask if you're found to have the COVID virus. So I think that's important.
Right. So you're pushing the importance of wearing a mask once you actually are confirmed to have coronavirus. But it seems health experts are saying you should wear it even if you do not. Do you agree with that then, to protect yourself?
There are an awful lot of people that think it's the great thing to do all the time. But I can't help but think that if I haven't been wearing a mask so much in the last 10 days or so, I really wonder if I would have gotten it. But I know, you know, moving the mask around, getting just right, I'm bound to put some virus on the mask that I sucked in. That's most likely what happened.
And that was Representative Louis Gohmert earlier today from Washington, D.C. Also today, Dr. Anthony Fauci discussed President Trump's continued promotion of the drug hydroxychloroquine and a conspiracy video that the president retweeted. Here he is with MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell.
How damaging is that, that he retweeted the video and defended it again today?
Well, the only thing that I can do, Andrea, is do what I've done all along consistently, is that you look at the scientific data and the evidence, and the scientific data, the cumulative data on trials, clinical trials that were valid, namely clinical trials that were randomized and controlled in the proper way. All of those trials show consistently that hydroxychloroquine is not effective in the treatment of coronavirus disease or COVID-19.
My family received an email yesterday from a young friend of ours, a university graduate. She's now back home in her village in rural western Kenya, asking us if now there's a cure because she had seen the video. And now I see today in the newspapers in Kenya warnings and columns to tell people don't believe that video. If this can be transmitted around the country and globally so rapidly, don't we have to do more to stop these dangerous conspiracies from misleading people?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, Andrea, and that's the reason why I'm very explicit and unambiguous when we say we've got to follow the science. If a study that's a good study comes out and shows efficacy and safety for hydroxychloroquine or any other drug that we do, if you do it in the right way, you accept the scientific data. But right now, today, the cumulative scientific data that has been put together and done over a number of different studies has shown no efficacy. So when there's a video out there for a bunch of people spouting something that isn't true, the only recourse you have is to be very, very clear in presenting the scientific data that essentially contradicts that.
And that was Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier today on MSNBC. Now, back on Capitol Hill, Speaker Nancy Pelosi was joined by fellow Democrats to discuss their Child Care is Essential Act. However, when it came time for questions, reporters only asked about the current status of the latest coronavirus relief bill. Here's the exchange with Speaker Pelosi, Representative Linda Sanchez, and a reporter.
Oh, yeah, back there.
Well, not on this topic yet, so are we into the non-childcare portion yet?
Can we please talk about childcare?
Yeah.
5 minutes?
No, this is the purpose.
Women live this every single day, and I get so tired of people thinking that what we have to say about this is not a priority. Are there questions about the bills or about what we're trying to achieve here on behalf of working families? Is that too much to ask?
Yes, I'm willing to wait.
Folks take an interest in that topic?
My first question was about that, but
yeah. Apparently.
Apparently not.
You know, I got the same reaction from my Republican colleagues in the Rules Committee who thought that it wasn't an emergency. I had somebody from the Budget Committee say, well, it doesn't meet the definition of emergency because it was an emergency before the pandemic. How is it how do we define it as an emergency so that, you know, it has an end date? I said, because it's a super emergency now. It was an emergency before. It is critical now. And we cannot assume that the business will go on as usual if we don't meet the needs of working parents. And this person was too old to have children under 18 years of age. But I do. I see it in my own household, and I see it in the households of my constituents. And if people think that it's not a problem, they're not living the reality of most American families where both parents have to work, or there's only one parent who has to support the household, or there are grandparents raising children because of drug overdoses. I get so tired of everybody wanting to talk about deals and red lines and not talk about what is relevant to the majority of families in this country. I'm sorry for that outburst, but it makes me so angry.
Well, what is so exciting about having so many young women in the Congress is that women across the country who are raising their families, parents across the country who are raising their families, and they see people contemporaneous who are contemporaries of theirs having children, have to weighing the timing of everything, it really gives people hope that the policy will be improved to match the reality of America's families' lives.
And that was Speaker Pelosi and Representative Linda Sanchez earlier today on Capitol Hill. And on the other side of the Capitol, Senator John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana, expressed his views about the current state of negotiations between Democrats and Republicans over the newest coronavirus relief package.
First, I just wanted to ask about today's lunch and whether there's any consensus on a short-term package or anything else.
We've made a little progress. A lot of senators spoke up. I ask the powers that be to take the spending porn out of the bills. I don't think now is an appropriate time to build the FBI new building. I don't think now is the appropriate time to renovate the West Wing of the White House. I don't like the provision in there to give $175 million to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And there's a lot of other spending porn in there that has no business being in the bill. I didn't know it was in the bill. I dug it out myself. I'm embarrassed about it. This is supposed to be a coronavirus bill. I think I can tell you where my focus is. I think in my state, there are many people who aren't going to have jobs to go back to. Thankfully, some are. We do need to help those who don't have jobs to go back to.
So, Alexander Bolton of The Hill publication, where are we with regard to the latest coronavirus aid package?
Well, talks right now are going on between Senate Democratic Leader Charles Schumer and Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the lead White House negotiators, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Mnuchin said at the start of Wednesday that the two sides are far apart, and that now has Senate Republicans looking to put together possibly, or at least discussing, a smaller package that would address the need for schools to open in the fall and to extend the federal enhancement of unemployment benefits that expire this week. Although this effort by Republicans seems more like a bid for political coverage than an actual solution. We've seen this in the past when there's been an intractable negotiation between the Trump administration and the Democrats in Congress. The Republicans in Congress like to put out these interim packages and vote for them to give them some, you know, political cover as the broader talks stall. So that could be what's going on. But the bottom line is the two sides are pretty far apart. Chuck Schumer is telling colleagues, according to one Democratic senator I spoke to, that the White House hasn't even begun negotiating in earnest, which is odd since the enhanced unemployment benefits expire this week and you had a moratorium on evictions expire last week. So it seems like they're really waiting till the last minute to get this done.
And what's the White House's position?
Well, the White House's position is they have some things they really want to get done, and some of them have been jettisoned early. For instance, a payroll tax cut for employees, that's something that the president was championing, but that's been tossed in the face of strong Democratic and Republican opposition. However, the president has prevailed, it looks, in his bid to put out another round of $1,200 stimulus checks that would go to people making up to $75,000 and then would slowly phase out as you get to the $99,000 mark. That was an idea that was not popular with Republicans, but it has survived and it will be in the next package if there is a next package because Democrats like it. One of the new wrinkles here, though, is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is insisting on a very aggressive liability protection provision that would span 5 years, apply retroactively to before the pandemic, and would really curtail the ability to file any sort of coronavirus lawsuits against employers, businesses, schools, colleges, churches. And so that's something the Democrats say is a non-starter. Pelosi and Schumer say that if that's going to be in the bill, as McConnell is insisting, there's not going to be a bill. So the rhetoric and the posturing is at a high level right now, and the progress is at a low level.
Now, Alexander Bolton, you mentioned that the House Democrats and the White House were negotiating. Often these big bill negotiations include the Republican Senate as well. Is there a reason that the Senate has not joined this effort?
Well, I also want to point out Chuck Schumer, so Senate Democrats and House Democrats are involved in negotiation with the White House. As to why the Senate Republicans aren't being involved, well, that's because there's a lot of opposition in the Senate Republican Conference to what's being discussed. And what's being discussed is a package that's probably going to be around $2 trillion, maybe even more, probably something along the lines of the CARES Act. And the political appetite in the Senate Republican Conference for this is low. And so that's why I think they're not going to really be party to this, because they fundamentally, or at least a substantial number of the Republicans in the GOP conference, Senate Republicans, oppose a package on the scale of what Mnuchin, Pelosi, and Schumer are talking about. So this is a little bit of replay of what happened in March during the negotiation of the CARES Act. The negotiation was primarily conducted between Mnuchin and the Democratic leaders, with McConnell, weighing in at times. We'll see if McConnell will weigh in as much as he did in March. But right now, it seems like the talks are primarily between the White House and Democrats.
And as you well know, end of July in Washington is often a busy time as Congress gets ready for its August recess. When is that scheduled for? Could it be delayed? And do you foresee at this point a bill passing before that?
Well, the Senate is supposed to leave for the August recess at the end of next week, so that takes them up until August 7th. And right now, if they're going to meet that deadline, they're really going to have to get moving. Of course, it's July 29th. John Cornyn, who's kind of a key negotiator here, he's still confident that a deal can be had by the end of next week, but given the dynamic as we're seeing now, that doesn't seem all that likely to me. The two sides are so far apart, but as we've seen in the past, it's darkest before dawn, and usually you'll have a round of, heated rhetoric and intransigence and lack of movement before there's a breakthrough. So I think the fundamental thing to remember here is that President Trump, he needs a big package from Congress to keep the economy from taking a more of a dip in the fall. So I think he's going to prevail, given his strength in the Republican Party.
So, Alexander Bolton, what were the effects of Jerome Powell of the Fed's remarks today?
I don't think Powell's remarks have that much impact, because what he said today is very similar to what he said in June. It's almost an identical statement. And he stated pretty much the obvious. The strength of the economy is going to depend on what happens with the coronavirus. Well, that's not a mystery to anyone here in Congress. And right now, it looks like the pandemic is getting worse, not better. And that is kind of a key difference from March, when folks negotiating aid were assuming that the pandemic would be stemmed more quickly. Right now, there is no end in sight. And so that argues for a big bill. But on the other hand, I think some Republicans are wondering, well, if this pandemic is going to last for months and months, what's the point of spending another $2 to $3 trillion that's ultimately going to get swallowed up by this black hole of economic slowdown?
Alexander Bolton of The Hill is one of the longest serving reporters here in Washington. You can read all of his material at thehill.com.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, according to CNN's Phil Mattingly, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows emerged from an afternoon meeting with Speaker Pelosi and Senator Schumer, telling reporters that, quote, we're nowhere close to a deal. Mr. Meadows said the enhanced unemployment benefits will expire on Friday, and there's no deal in the works. Now, in other news, the Pentagon today laid out a plan to shift nearly 12,000 service members out of Germany. President Trump has said that that country was delinquent on defense spending. Top defense leader said the plan, which would bring 6,400 service members home and reposition nearly 5,600 to other countries in Europe, is part of the Pentagon's broader effort to redistribute U.S. forces across the world to better compete with new threats from Russia and China. The move will leave 24,000 troops in Germany, where the U.S. has stationed a significant number of forces since the end of the Cold War. Now, here's Secretary of Defense Mark Esper earlier today.
The current EUCOM plan will reposition approximately 11,900 military personnel from Germany, from roughly 36,000 down to 24,000, in a manner that will strengthen NATO, enhance the deterrence of Russia, and meet the other principles I set forth. Of the 11,900, nearly 5,600 service members will be repositioned within NATO countries, and approximately 6,400 will return to the United States, though many of these or similar units will begin conducting rotational deployments back to Europe. The broad strokes of these moves are as follows. First, various United States headquarters will be consolidated in locations in Europe outside of Germany, including, in some cases, co-locating at the same locations as their NATO counterparts in Belgium and Italy. This will strengthen NATO and improve the operational efficiency and readiness of over 2,000 service members in these headquarters.
And that was Secretary of Defense Mark Esper earlier today at the Pentagon. Secretary Esper said that the plan will enhance NATO's ability to deter Russian aggression and strengthen U.S. alliances in Europe, yet also reiterated the president's criticism of Germany. And finally today, Georgia Congressman John Lewis made his way to Atlanta, where he is lying in state at the Georgia State Capitol. Attendees to an invitation-only service included the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, and Atlanta Mayor Keisha Bottoms. Here's the Atlanta mayor.
I was deeply moved a couple of days ago when his chief of staff, Michael Collins, shared with me that the congressman was intently watching the news of Atlanta and proud of the leadership that's been shown. And so, Governor, when the good trouble continues, know that it is with the blessings of Congressman Lewis. And although the fight for liberty and equality continues, Congressman Lewis reminded us to be hopeful, to be optimistic, and to never lose a sense of hope. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where every man is free.
And that was Atlanta Mayor Keisha Bottoms earlier today. Well, that's it for Wednesday's edition. You can find Washington Today wherever you get your podcasts or go to our website at cspan.org/podcast.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day, we're taking your calls live on the air, on the news of the day, and discussing policy issues that impact you. Coming up Thursday morning, Maryland Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin, a member of the House Judiciary Committee, will be on to talk about Attorney General William Barr's testimony before the committee this week. Then Maryland's Republican Governor Larry Hogan discusses his new book, Still Standing, on the role of governors in combating COVID-19 and his political future. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal live at 7 Eastern Thursday morning. And be sure to join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, text messages, and tweets.